Varney the Vampire of the Feast of Blood. Chapter 7. Charles Holland's sad feelings, the portrait, the occurrence of the night at the hall. Charles Holland wished to be alone. If ever any human being had wished fervently to be so, his thoughts were most fearfully oppressive. Communication had been made to him by Henry Bennerworth. Had about it too many strange confirmatory circumstances to enable him to treat it in his own mind with disrespect, as some mere freak of distracted and weak imagination would most probably have received from him. He found Verona in a state of excitement which could arise only from some terrible cause that had been mentioned by her brother, and then he was, from an occurrence which currently never could have been entered into his calculations, asked for a golden bright dream of happiness which he had held so long, so rapturously to his heart. How truly he found that the course of true love ran not smooth, and yet how little would anyone have suspected that from such a cause that which now oppressed his mind any obstruction could arise. Fernand might have been freckled and false. He might have seen some other fair face which might have been chained his fancy, woven with him, a new heart chain. Death might have stepped between him and realization, found his hopes loss of a fortune, might have made his love cruel, which would have yonked so to distresses a young and beautiful girl reared in that luxury, who was not even by those who loved her suffered to feel, even in later years, any of the pinching necessaries of the family. All these things are possible. Some of them were probable, yet none of them had occurred. She loved him still, and he, though he'd looked on many a fair face and basked in sunny smiles of beauty, had never for a moment forgotten her faith or lost his devotion to his own dear English girl. Fortune he had enough for both. Death had not even threatened to rob him of the prize, such a noble and faithful heart, which he had won. A horrible superstition had arisen, which seemed to place at once impassable abyss between them, and to say to him a voice of thundering doom and nation, Charles Holland, you have a vampire for your bride. The thought was terrific. He paced the gloomy chamber to and fro with rapid strides, till the idea came across his mind that by so doing he might not only be reclaiming to his kind and saying is how much he was mentally distracted, he likewise might be seriously distracting them. Moment this occurred to him, he sat down and was profoundly still for some time. He then glanced at the light which had been given to him. He found himself almost unconsciously engaged in mental calculation as of how long it would last him in the night. Half ashamed then, such terrors, as such a consideration was seemed to indicate he was on the point of hastily extinguishing it, when he happened to cast his eyes on a now mysteriously and highly interesting portrait in the panel. A picture as light as a picture was well done, whether it was of correct likeness or not of the party whom it represented, is one of those kind of portraits which seem so lifelike that so you look at them, they seem to return your grace fully, even follow you with our eyes from place to place. By candlelight, such as the effect, it more likely becomes striking and remarkable than by daylight. And now Charles Holland shaded his own eyes for light as to cast a full radiance upon of her portrait. He felt wonderfully interested in his lifelike appearance. Here is a true skill, he said, such as I have been never seen before. Such as I have not before seen. How strange is the likeness of a man I never saw seem to gaze upon me. Unconsciously too, he aided the effect, which he suggested enough, called lifelike by a slight movement of candle, such as anyone who not blessed with nerves of iron but a sure to make. At such a moment, his face looked as if it was barred with eternity. Charles remained looking at the portrait for a considerable period of time, found a kind of fascination in it, which prevented him from drawing his eyes away from it. It was not fear which induced him to continue gazing on it, but the circumstances that it was the likeness of man who, after death, was supposed to have borrowed a so new and so hideous existence, combined with its artistic merits, chained him to the spot. "I shall now," he said, "know that face again. Let me see where I may, under what senses I may. Each feature is now indelibly fixed upon my memory. I never can mistake it." Turned aside as he uttered these words, he did so, his eyes fell upon a part of the whole mental frame which composed the edge of the panel, which seemed to him to be a different colour from sphere and repulsion. As he increased interest prompted him at once to make a clearer, close inquiry into the matter. By careful and diligent scrutiny, he is almost induced to come a positive opinion. It is not a very distant period of time past. Period had been removed from the place it occupied. When once this idea, even vague and instinct, was it, as it was in concurrence, the slight grounds he formed it on, and got possession of his mind, felt more sensitive to prove its veracity or its fallacy. He held the candle in a variety of situations, so that light might fail in different ways of picture. The more he examined it, the more he felt convinced it must have been moved lately. It would appear as if his removal of a piece of old oaken carved framework for the panel had actually broken off, which caused a new look like a fracture. This accident, from the nature of the broken bit of framing, would have occurred any other way than from an actual attempted removal of the picture, he felt was extremely unlikely. He set down the candle on a chair near at hand and tried if the panel was fast in its place. Upon the very first touch, he felt convinced, not so, that he easily moved. How to get it out, though, presented a difficulty. He got it out and to get it out was tempting. Who knows, he said to himself, what may I be behind it? This is not an old barren old sort of hole. Great proportion of it was, no doubt, built at a time when the construction such places of hidden chambers, intricate staircases were, in old buildings of importance, considered a decided rente. That he should make certain discovery behind the portrait now became an idea that possessed him strongly, though he certainly had no definitive grounds for really supposing that he should do so. Perhaps the witch was more farther to the fault than he. In a perpetual state of excitement he was in, it may be imagined, but not so it was. So it was. He felt convinced that he should not be satisfied until he had removed the panel from the wall, seeing what was immediately behind it. After the panel containing the picture had been placed where it was, appeared that pieces of moulding been studied all around, which had been an effect of keeping it in place. It was fractured with one of these pieces, which had first called George Holland's attention to the probability of the picture having been removed. Then he should have to get two at least of the pieces moulding away before he could hope to remove the picture was to him quite apparent. He was considering how he should accomplish such a result, and suddenly startled by a knock at his chamber door. Till the sudden demand for admission, his door came. He scarcely knew to what the nervous state he'd worked himself up. An odd sort of tap, one only a single tap. If it seemed one demanding admittance and wished to have taken his attention, the least possible chance of disturbing anyone else. "Come in," said Charles, for he knew he did not fasten his door. "Come in." There was no reply, but after a moment's pause, same sort of low tap came again. Again he cried, "Come in." But wherever it was, seemed determined that door should be opened for him, and no movement was made from the office outside. Third time the tap came, and Charles was very close to the door when he heard it, for it was a noiseless step. He had approached it, intending to open it. Instantly his third mysterious demand mission came, he did it, opened it wide. There was no one there. And instantly crossed the threshold into the corridor and ran right and left. A window at one end that now sent in the moon rays so that it tried to be light. But he could see no one instead. Indeed, he looked for one anyone. Need to look for anyone, he might felt sure was needless, for he had to open the chamber door almost certainly from the last knock for admission. "It's strange," he said as he lingered on the threshold of his room door for some moments. "Imagination could not so completely deceive me." There was most certainly a demand of admission. Slowly then he returned to his room again, closed the door behind him. "One thing is evident," he said, "if I am in this apartment, be subtracted to these annoyances, I shall get no rest, which will soon exhaust me." His thought was a very provoking one, and the more he thought he should ultimately find necessary for giving up that chamber, he had himself asked a special favour to allow to occupy, more vexed became to think that construction might be put upon his conduct for so long, so doing. "It will all fancy me a coward," he thought. "I dare not sleep here. They may not, of course, say so. They will think that my appearing so bold was one of those acts of bravado which are not courage to carry fairly out." Taking his view of the matter was just the way to enlist the new young man's pride in staying and all successes where he was, and with a slight accentuation of colour, which, even though he was alone, could visit his cheeks, trails on, so loud I remain the occupant of this room. Come what may, happen what may, no terror is real or substantial which should drive me from it. I will brave them all, remain here to brave them. Tap came to knock on the door again, now with more an air of vexation and fear. Charles turned around again towards it and listened. Tap in another minute again succeeded. Much annoyed, he walked across to the door, laid his hand upon the lock, said he ready to open it, at a precise moment of another demand for mission being made. He had not to wait long. About half a minute they came again simultaneously. The sound of the door flew open. There was no one to be seen, but he opened the door, heard a strange sound of corridor, sound which scarcely would be called a groan and scarcely a sigh. About seeing the compound of both, having the agony of one combined with the sadness of the other, from what his direction it came, he could not at all remember his side, but where he called out, "Who's there? Who's there?" The echo of his own voice alone. Echo answered from him a few moments. Then he heard a door open, a voice which he heard, knew to be Henry's, cried, "Was it? Who speaks? Henry," said Charles. "Yes, yes, I fear I have disturbed you." "Yeah, but you have been disturbed yourself. Are you? Could not, would have not done so. I shall be with you in a moment." Henry closed his door before Harry Trevelyan could help him now, not tell him not to come to him, as he tended to, but he felt ashamed to have, in a manner speaking, summoned assistance for so trifling a cause alarm, so as that of which he had been subjected. However, he would not go to Henry's chamber to bid him for coming into his, and more vexed than before, retired his room again to wait his coming. He left the room door open now, so Henry Bennenworth, when he had got some articles addressed, walked in once again, saying, "What has happened, Charles? A mere rifle, Henry, concerning which I am ashamed you. You should have been at all distributed. Never mind that, I was wakeful. I heard a door open, which kept me listening, but I could not decide which doctor it was until I heard your voice in the corridor." "Well, it was the first door. I opened it twice in concurrence. Repeat taps of my mission. It came to. Someone was been knocking at it. And when I got to it, lo, I could see nobody. Indeed, such is the case, and you surprise me." "I'm very sorry to have disturbed you, because upon such a ground, I do not feel that I ought to have done so. I called out in the corridor, I assure you, There is to no such intention. Do not regret it for a moment, said Henry. You are quite justified in making alarm on such occasion. Strange enough, but still it may arise from some accidental cause submitting it. He did, sir, did, but he knew, did not know it. Or some ready enough explanation. It may certainly, but after what's happened already, we may well suppose a mysterious connection between any unusual sight or sound, and fearful ones we've already seen. Clearly we may, how earnestly that strange portrait seems to look upon us, Charles, it does. I've been examining it carefully. It seems to have been removed lately. Removed? Yes, I think, as far as I can judge, it's been taken from its frame. I mean, the panel on which it painted, been taken out. Indeed, if you touch it, you will find it loose and upon its closest examinations. You see that a piece of moulding which holds it in place has been chipped off, which is done in such a place. I think it could only have been risen during the removal of that picture. You must be mistaken, of course. I'll not, of course, take upon myself, Henry, to say precisely such is the case, said Charles. But there is no one here to do so. But I cannot say, will you permit me and assist me to remove it? I have a great curiosity to know behind it. If you have, I certainly will do so. We thought of taking it away altogether. When Flora left this room, the idea was given up as useless. Remain here a few moments. I endeavour to find something which shall assist us in its removal. Henry left the mysterious chamber in order to search his own for some means of removing the framework of the picture, so that the panel would slip easily out. While he was gone, Charles Holland continued grazing upon it with a greater interest, if possible, than before. In a few minutes, Henry turned and lo, what he had succeeded in finding were very efficient implements for the purpose. Yet, with his aid, the two young men set about their task. It is said truly enough that where there is a will, there is a way. And though the young men had no tools at all adapted to the purpose, they did succeed in removing the moulding from the panels or the sides of the panel. Then, by a little tapping at one end of it, using the knife as a lever at the other end of the panel, they got it fairly out. Disappointment was all they got for their plans. On the other side was nothing but rough wooden wall, against which the finer, more nicely finished opening, the chamber rested. There is no mystery here, said Charlie. None whatsoever, said Charles, as he tapped the wall with his knuckles and found all the hard sound. We have foiled, we are indeed. A strange presentiment now, said Charles. We should have some discovery that would not repay us for our trouble. It appears, however, that such is not to be the case of it. You see, nothing presents itself to us but the most ordinary appearances. Receive as much the panel itself, though of more than the usual fitness, is after all but a bit of plain oak, and apparently fashioned for no other object than to paint the portrait on. True, shall we replace it? Charles reluctantly deserted. The picture was placed as its original position. We say, Charles reluctantly deserted, because although he had now the ocular demonstration, there was no really nothing behind the panel but its jewellery paint woodwork, which might have been expected from the construction of the old house. Yet he could not, even with such a fact staring him at the facts, get them read entirely of the feeling that had come across him to the fact the picture had some history or another. He was still not as yet satisfied, said Henry. He deserved a doubtful look of Charles Holland's face. My dear friend, said Charles, I will not deceive you. I am much disappointed. We have made no discovery behind that picture. Heaven knows we have mysteries enough, our family, said Henry. Even he spoke, they both started by a strange clattering noise at the window, which was accompanied by a shrill, odd kind of shriek, which sounded fearful, natural. Well, what is that, said Charles. God, I know, said Henry. Two young men naturally turned their eyes gaze in the direction of the window, which we have before marked as one and bloody with shutters. There, to their intense surprise, he saw slowly rising up the lower part of it, which appeared to be a human form. Henry would have dashed forward, but Charles restrained him, and drawing quickly from its case a large poster pistol, he levelled it carefully at the figure, saying in a whisper, "Henry, if you don't hit it, it will represent consent to forfeit my head." Pull the trigger. A loud report followed. The moon was filled with smoke. Then there was all was still. Sam Tess, however, occurred as a consequence of the concussion of the air, produced the discharge of the pistol, which neither the young men had for the moment calculated upon. That was putting out the only light they had. In spite of this circumstance, Charles, the moment he had discharged the pistol, dropped it and sprang forward to the window. But there he was perplexed, for he could not find old-fashioned intricate fastening which held it shut. He had to call for Henry. "Henry, for God's sake, open the window for me. Henry, the fastening on the window is known to you, but not to me. Open it for me." Thus called upon, Henry sprang forward. By his time, the pistol was efficiently alarmed. The whole household, flashing the lights through the corridor, came to the room in another minute. Just as Henry was Henry seated in the window wide open, Charles Unwin made his way up on to balcony both. Charles Bennymouth and Mr. Barchdale entered the chamber, eager to know what had occurred. To their eager questions, Henry replied, "Ask me not now." Then turning to Charles, he said, "Remain where you are, Charles, while I run down to the garden immediately beneath the balcony." "Yes, yes," said Charles. Henry made producers at pace, was in the garden immediately below the bay window in an old wonderfully short space of time. But Charles saying, "Will you now descend? I see nothing here. Where we will both make a search, Charles." George and Mr. Marchdale were both now in the balcony, and they would have descended likewise, but Henry said, "Do not leave the house. God only knows our situation we are, what might happen." "I will return then," said George. "I have been sitting up tonight as a guard, and therefore may as well continue to do so." Marchdale and Charles Holland clambered at the balcony and easily, from its insipid height, dropped into the garden. The night was beautiful, profoundly still. There's not a breath of air significant to stir a leaf on a tree, the very flame of the candle which Charles left burning in the balcony, burnt clearly and steadily, being perfectly unraveled by the windy wind. It cast a sniffing light close to the window, make everything more plainly visible. It evident at a glance that no object was there, although I had that figure which Charles shot at, and no doubt hit. There had been flesh about it, might have been dropped immediately below. As he looked up for a moment after a cursory examination of the ground, Charles exclaimed, "Look at that window. It's lightly now situated. You can see the hole made in one of the panes. Glass by the passage or bullet from my pistol." They did look, and there, a clear round hole, vanity staring, where a hole burly discharged that close to the brain glass would make it. "The clearly and painfully discernible. You must have hit him," said Henry. "Well, one would think so," said Charles. "What was that was that place where the figure was." "There's nothing here," said Marchdale. "What can we think of these events? What resource of mind against the most dreadful suspicions concerning them?" Charles and Henry were silent in truth. They knew not what to think. The words uttered by Marchdale were too strikingly true. Disrupt for a moment, they were lost in wonder. "Human means against such an appearance as we saw tonight," said Charles, "was utterly useless." "My dear young friend," said Marchdale, "such much emotion as he grasped Henry Vandenberg's hand, and tears shook in his eyes as he did so. "My dear young friend, those consistent lines will kill you. You will drive you and all those happiness you hold dear distracted. You must control these dreadful feelings. There is but one chance I can see of getting now the better of these. What is that? By leaving this place forever. Alas, I am to be driven from the house. As for such a cause as this, Whatever I do to fly, wherever we are to find a refuge, to leave here will be at once a break up the establishment. We're now being held together, certainly upon the significance of creditors, but still to the advantages. Advantages as much as I'm doing what no one else would do, namely paying away to within the scant expectance. Whole pieces of the tide that spreads around me, hey, nothing but an escape from it, such horrors as seem to be accumulating now around you. If I was sure such a removal would bring with it such a corresponding advantage, may indeed be induced to risk all it compass yet. God's dear Verona, said Mr. Marchdale, I know not what to say or what to think. She had been attacked by a vampire. And after this mortal life shall be ended, it's dreadful to think there may be possibility that she, with all her beauty, all her excellence and beauty of mind, there are those virtues and qualities which should make her the beloved of all, which do indeed attach all hearts towards her, should become one of those dreadful tribe of beings who clean as this by feeding most dreadful men upon the life blood of others. Oh, it's too dreadful to complete, too horrible, too horrible. Never therefore to speak of it, said Charles, with such asperity. Now by the great God of heaven, who sees all our hearts, I will not give in to such a horrible dream. I do not believe it. And where death itself my portion, or my want for faith, I will this moment die in my belief of anything so truly fearful. Ah, my young friend, said Marchdale. If anything would add to the pangs which all love and admire and respect for Elder Benhamworth must feel, an unhappy condition in which she is placed, it would be the noble grace of you, who under happier places would have been our guide for life and happy partner of our destiny, as will be still. May heaven forbid it, we are now among ourselves. Can talk freely upon such a subject, Mr. Charles. Well, if you wed, you would look forward to being blessed with children. Those sweet ties would bind a sinner to his heart to life. Such exquisite a bond of fancy then. A moment the mother of your baby's coming, and all still hour of the morning and night, to drain from your veins the very lifeblood she gave to them, to drive you and your name mad, respect that horror of such vegetations, make your nights wedges. Your days, not so many hours of melancholy retrospection. Oh, you know not the world of terror. Oh, the awful brink of which there you stand. When you're talking of making Fiona Benworth a wife, peace, oh, peace, said the giant ray. Nay, I know my words are unwelcome, continued Mr. Marchdale. It happens, unfortunately, for human nature, that truth and some of our best and holiest feelings, not too often valiance, behold a sad contest. You will not hear no more of this, cried George Holland. I'll hear no more I have done, said Mr. Marchdale. And there will you have not begun. Nay, say not so. I have but done what I considered was a doom and duty. Under that assumption of doing duty, the solemn duty heedless, the feelings, the opinions of us, said Charles, sarcastically, more mischief is produced, more heart burnings, anxieties caused, and by any other two causes of such mischief results combined. We shall hear no more of this. Do not be angered with Mr. Marchdale, Charles, said Henry. He have no motive for our welfare in what he says we should not condemn as a speaker, because his words may not sound pleasant to our ears. By heaven, said Charles, vehemently, I meant not to be liberal, but I will not not because I cannot see a man's motive for active interference in the affairs of others, or he'd be ready merely to account for such ignorance, to have jumped to conclusion, and must be estimable. Tomorrow I leave this house, said Marchdale. Leave us, exclaimed Henry. Aye, forever. Nay, now, Mr. Marchdale, is that this is generous? I am treated generously by one who is your greatest own guest, and to all whom I am willing to hold out the right, honest right hand of friendship. Henry turned to Charles Holland again, saying, Charles, I know your translation say you meant no offence, my mother's old friend. But you have to say, I meant no offence to Charles. You say, I meant no insult. I say it freely. And now, said Marchdale, I am satisfied. But do not, added Charles, draw me any more such pictures as one you have already presented to my imagination. Beg to you from the storehouse of my own fancy. I can find quite enough to make me wrenched if I choose to do so. Again, again, do I say, do not allow this monstrous superstition to creep me down, the tread of a giant on a broken wheel. I will contend against it while I have life to do so. Bravely spoken. And when I desert, throne of Enneworth, may heaven from that moment desert me. Charles, cried Henry, with emotion. Dear Charles, my more than friend, brother of my heart, noble Charles. Nay, Henry, I am not entitled to your praise. I wear grace, indeed, to be another than at which I propose to be. Come will or woe, come what may, I am a fancied husband with your sister, and she only can break asunder a tie that binds me to her.